This episode features discussion of kidnapping and violence that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised.
January 8, 1985. 50-year-old Father Lawrence Martin Jenko slid into the passenger seat of the car. His driver, Khaled, greeted him as Abuna, the Arabic word for our father. Then they took off down the streets of Beirut.
Khaled was Muslim, while Father Jenko was a Catholic priest. Despite their religious differences, they had developed a fond appreciation for each other. Father Jenko always looked forward to his morning drive to the Catholic Relief Services mission where he worked.
The car rounded the corner near Beirut's American University. College students flooded the sidewalks, while parents held hands with small children on their way to school. Father Jenko smiled to himself. No matter where he was in the world, some things always looked the same.
His eyes focused on a peculiar scene on the street ahead. A grocer was standing in the road, directing traffic, while four policemen chatted nonchalantly on the sidewalk. It was a bizarre role reversal. Father Jenko turned to tell Khaled.
No sooner had the words left his mouth than the sound of automatic weapons broke the morning calm. Three men leapt off the sidewalk in front of Father Jenko's car, firing their guns wildly at the sky.
They began to charge the vehicle. Father Jenko turned to see two more gunmen rushing the car from behind. He held his breath. He knew what was coming.
This is Hostage, a Parcast original. Every week, we tell the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
We'll also cover the psychological tactics used in kidnapping situations and what the human brain does when held captive.
I'm Irma Blanco.
And I'm Carter Roy.
You can find episodes of Hostage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Hostage for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Hostage in the search bar.
At Parcast, we are grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you are listening. It really does help. This is our first episode on the kidnapping of Father Lawrence Martin Jenko, a Roman Catholic priest captured by the Lebanese terrorist group Hezbollah.
On January 8, 1985, 50-year-old Father Jenko was on his way to work at the Catholic Relief Services in Beirut when five gunmen hijacked his car. They kidnapped the priest, transporting him through a series of makeshift prisons. In the 18 months that followed, Father Jenko's abduction gained national attention as one of several U.S. kidnappings by the Lebanese terrorist group.
In today's episode, we'll learn the circumstances that brought Father Lawrence Martin Jenko to Beirut and discuss the botched terrorist attack that led to his capture. We'll also discover the origins of Lebanon's most elusive terrorist organization and meet the mastermind behind their infamous attacks.
Next week, we'll follow the shifting landscape of Father Jenko's captivity and learn how he survived foul living conditions and physical and emotional abuse. We'll also find out how the U.S. responded to the priest's abduction and the role his family played in the international hostage crisis.
In 1982, during the seventh year of civil war between Muslims and the Christians, known as the Falanges, the conflict in Lebanon reached a fever pitch.
A series of transgressions from the anti-Israeli group known as the Palestinian Liberation Organization, or PLO, had led Israel to invade Lebanon that June. Israel quickly gained control of Beirut with the help of their Falanges allies. And in August, 800 U.S. Marines arrived to help remove the PLO from Lebanon.
Israel's next move was to install a pro-Israeli phalange president. When the new leader was assassinated by a member of the Syrian Social Nationalist Party, an anti-colonialist group angered by Israel's invasion, the phalanges immediately blamed the murder on the PLO. Their revenge was as merciless as it was tragic.
On September 16, 1982, Israeli troops guarding two Palestinian refugee camps allowed 170 Falange soldiers inside. As many as 3,500 Palestinians were raped, brutalized, and murdered. Among them were children and the elderly.
This bloody massacre sent shockwaves through Lebanon. Israel lost most of its minority supporters, and its enemies were more furious than ever. One man in particular was determined to punish Israel and its Western allies. His name was Imad Mughniyeh.
Imad Mughniyeh was born in 1962 in a small Shia village in South Lebanon. The eldest son of a poor fruit farmer, his family eventually relocated to a majority Shia neighborhood in South Beirut.
In Beirut, young Imad began attending Shia school, where he thrived. Those who knew him at the time remembered him as an intelligent student from a peaceful Shia family. However, Imad grew up surrounded by intolerant political and religious factions in Lebanon, who were increasingly resorting to violence. As time went on, teenage Imad also began to develop an interest in Lebanese politics.
So when Lebanon's civil war broke out in 1975, the 13-year-old was quick to seek military training. He was granted his first weapons at a Palestinian military camp.
According to Dr. Mike Wessels, a psychologist with Columbia University, children who grow up surrounded by discrimination and danger are more likely to form a victim identity. Additionally, exposure to violence during key developmental years effectively breeds desensitized adults who are more likely to perceive themselves as victims. They also tend to believe violence is a normal part of life.
Young Imad is likely an example of this. Surrounded by intolerance and danger from an early age, it's unsurprising that the politically interested Imad sought to align himself with a particular cause and protect himself with weapons. As he got older, Imad would regard himself and his political cause as the real victim, using violence to get what he wanted.
In 1979, 17-year-old Imad began attending engineering school at the American University in Beirut, where he became increasingly interested in Lebanon's sectarian divides in the Islamic Revolution in Iran, which had taken place in the previous year. Imad sympathized with Iran's Shia Muslim revolutionaries. He reveled in their victory, which installed an Islamic government in Iran. He longed for a similar movement in Lebanon.
Imad was not alone in his ambitions. His best friend and cousin, a daredevil named Mustafa Badreddin, shared his vision of Lebanon. Together, the young men volunteered under Yasser Arafat's branch of the PLO, where they proved to be effective organizers. One day in particular, Imad and Mustafa showed up to camp with 100 teenage fighters in tow. They had recruited the boys entirely on their own.
Imad, in particular, showed leadership potential, and in 1981, at the age of 19, PLO officials introduced him to top officials from the Islamic Revolutionary Guard in Iran.
Imad learned that Iran was plotting to fund a resistance in Lebanon to aid their own interests and strike at Israel. And this would have been a dream come true for Imad, who had been hoping to bring the Iranian Revolution to Lebanon.
It was during this time that Imad became acquainted with an Iranian cleric named Ali Akbar Mutashamipour and a Lebanese cleric named Abbas al-Musawi. Together, these three men began to grow their own extremist military in Lebanon following Israel's invasion. They would eventually name it Hezbollah.
Their first mission was to expel Israel and its Western allies from Lebanon. They also wanted to punish the Falanges for their crimes against humanity, particularly the refugee massacre. To them, Israel was equally accountable for enabling this heinous crime. They held Israel's allies responsible for not adequately denouncing it, especially America.
Anti-Americanism was its own tenet in Hezbollah doctrine. Not only did America's consumerism and licentiousness offend their religious beliefs, but its capitalist system ran contrary to their concept of a fair society. In their view, the U.S. alliance with Israel and its peacekeeping initiative in Lebanon were selfish facades for gaining control in the Middle East. They loathed America, dubbing it the Great Satan and the root of evil.
Hezbollah deployed guerrilla tactics, snipers, car bombs, and suicide missions to strike their enemies. And their soldiers were zealots in both the political and religious sense. They truly saw themselves as the hope of Islam in Lebanon and believed in the righteousness of their cause, no matter how violent the cost.
According to a study on psychological mechanisms involved in radicalization conducted by the University of Oradea, it is a normal human reaction to draw definitive conclusions about perceived threats to our well-being. These conclusions can lead us to form a chain of absolute beliefs about how things should always be.
The train of thought usually stops there. However, extremist leaders take it a step further, conjuring up a fantasy world where their own absolute beliefs reign supreme. They select followers who share these beliefs and convince them that this fantasy is possible and must be achieved at any price.
This was the case with Hezbollah's extremists. They identified outside threats and formed unbending beliefs about the way things ought to be. To these extremists, their absolutist fantasy was more important than even their own lives. Ahmad's cousin, Mustafa, perfectly exemplified this ruthless devotion.
Regarded today as an architect of modern terrorism, Mustafa Badruddin had extensive knowledge of bombs and terrorist tactics. He even developed a new technique for using gas in plastic bombs to make them even more explosive. In short, he was Hezbollah's most lethal asset.
So it was no surprise that Mustafa masterminded their most notorious attack, which occurred barely a year after the Palestinian refugee massacre.
On October 23, 1983, a Hezbollah truck loaded with explosives plowed through steel fences and sandbag walls into the U.S. Marine barracks near Beirut's International Airport. It detonated, killing 241 U.S. service members. It was the most Americans ever killed in a single terrorist attack before 9/11.
Hezbollah proudly claimed responsibility for the bombing, referring to themselves by their favorite nickname, Islamic Jihad, which translates to holy war. In fact, Hezbollah had a rotating list of monikers they used prior to announcing their official identity in 1985. They wielded this ambiguity as a tool to frustrate their foreign enemies.
No one appreciated the value of this obscurity quite like Ahmad. Unlike other famous terrorists, Ahmad Mughniyeh repelled any temptation to grandstand. Throughout his life, he never allowed pictures to be taken of his face. He was even rumored to have had plastic surgery in later years to alter his appearance. In fact, it was not until after his death in 2008 that several of his own children would learn that their father was anything more than a chauffeur.
Ahmad operated exclusively under fake names for his entire adult life. His recurring favorite became Haj Radwan.
In fact, it was under this name that Father Lawrence Martynchenko would soon meet this infamous agent of terror.
In a moment, Father Jenko comes face to face with Hezbollah terrorists. Now back to the story.
Father Lawrence Martinchenko was born November 27, 1934, in the South Chicago suburb of Joliet, Illinois. One of seven children in a working-class Czech-Slovak family, his active imagination helped him turn everyday objects into unconventional toys.
One of his favorite games was to build a makeshift house from tables, chairs, and blankets. He would crawl inside, pretending he was a miniature person in a tiny house. Years later, he would use this game to pass the grueling hours of confinement.
The Jenko family was an affectionate, close-knit bunch. His parents were devout Catholics who lived next door to their local parish, where Lawrence, who was known to most as Marty, attended school and served as an altar boy on Sundays. It was there that he became fascinated with the Catholic saints. Admiring their selfless devotion, Marty decided that he wanted to be a priest.
For his first 2 years of high school, Marty attended a Carmelite seminary in Niagara Falls, New York. It was a difficult 2 years. He was homesick and envied the other boys in his program whose families lived close by. So for his last 2 years of high school, he relocated to St. Joseph's Seminary, just 30 miles from home in Illinois.
After high school, and in spite of his experience with homesickness, Marty's priestly ambitions drew him away from home once more. This time, he felt ready and excited for what lay ahead. He made his way to California to study for the priesthood before attending the prestigious Pontifical University in Rome. At 24 years old, Marty was ordained a Roman Catholic priest.
Wanting to live a life of service, Father Jenko joined the Servite Order of Priests. Eventually, he began his work for the Catholic Relief Services, whose mission was to aid disaffected populations across the globe. Whenever the mission needed him somewhere new, Father Jenko willingly uprooted his life. His work brought him to Australia, the Yemen Arab Republic, and Thailand.
It was while he was in Bangkok, Thailand, caring for Cambodian refugees, that he received the fateful call that would bring him to Beirut, Lebanon.
On July 4, 1984, 49-year-old Father Jenko's supervisor informed him of a new position. The Catholic mission in Beirut needed a new program director. The current director, a priest named Father Joseph Curtin, had been running the mission in Beirut since before the Israeli invasion. The years of exceeding chaos had taken its toll on Father Curtin's health. It was high time for him to retire.
Father Jenko had been selected as the top candidate to take his place. His previous experience as a hospital administrator in India and his time spent in the Yemen Arab Republic made him a perfect fit.
When his supervisor asked if he was interested, Father Jenko said yes. He would be given 2 months to visit his family before beginning his new position in October.
His supervisor also informed him that he would be taking over Father Curtin's old apartment in Beirut as well. Unbeknownst to Father Lawrence, this small practicality would ultimately cost him his freedom.
Meanwhile, Imad Mughniyeh, a young leader of the Lebanese extremist group Hezbollah, had recently married his cousin, Sada. She was the sister to Imad's other cousin and best friend, Mustafa Badreddin. The two young radicals were now best friends, cousins, and brother-in-laws. But most importantly, they were co-conspirators.
Following Hezbollah's 1983 bombing of the U.S. Marine barracks in Beirut, Imad worked once more with Mustafa to pull off the organization's next terrorist attack. It was going to be a massive undertaking, one that required Mustafa's expertise. Their target was Kuwait. At this time, Iran was engaged in war against Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq. Kuwait had been supporting Saddam, giving Hezbollah reason to target the country.
On December 12, 1983, Iranian and Lebanese Shiite extremists, including Mustafa Badreddin, bombed six different targets in Kuwait City. But events did not go as planned. A suicide bomber who was supposed to hit the U.S. embassy mistakenly rammed into the building next door, setting off only a quarter of the bombs. Overall, a plot that should have murdered hundreds of people only killed five.
To make matters worse for Hezbollah, a total of 17 suspects were arrested for the bombings. One of them was Mustafa.
When Ahmad heard the news of Mustafa's capture, he was beside himself with grief and rage. His brother-in-law's freedom quickly became an important factor in Hezbollah's next actions.
The months following Mustafa's capture were harrowing for Ahmad. He was an energetic young man, and part of this energy manifested itself as rage. Not only had he lost his best friend and relative, but Hezbollah was short one of their best men.
Around this time, Iran was sanctioning Western kidnappings, hoping to use humans as effective bargaining chips for their various interests. Hezbollah followed suit. On the morning of March 7th, 1984, CNN's correspondent to Beirut, Jerry Levin, was walking to work when he was kidnapped by a Hezbollah gunman. Then, less than 2 weeks later, on March 16th, CIA official William Buckley was abducted from his car on his way to work at the U.S. Embassy.
When news of the kidnappings reached the White House, U.S. intelligence could only surmise that it was part of the continued guerrilla retaliation against American aid to Lebanon. But President Ronald Reagan was not about to withdraw U.S. interest in the region, much less give in to scare tactics.
So, on April 3, 1984, Reagan issued a classified national security directive to the CIA. In it, he stated the increased terrorist threat to American civilians abroad and suggested that measures should be taken to preemptively discover these plots.
In the meantime, Hezbollah had devised another type of target. In order to effectively intimidate their American enemies, they would not only focus on individuals with so-called important positions. No, they would show the U.S. just how ruthless, how chaotic these kidnappings could be.
A little over a month later, on May 8th, 60-year-old American Reverend Benjamin Weir was abducted while out walking in Beirut. It was a seemingly senseless kidnapping, for which Hezbollah was quick to take credit.
Calling themselves Islamic Jihad, Hezbollah attributed the kidnappings to their vow to eradicate American presence on Lebanese soil. In the meantime, they released videos over the next several months, each depicting their CIA captive William Buckley in various states of abuse. The U.S. remained firm in their position, but tensions in Washington ran high. Then, on December 3, 1984, 60-year-old American librarian Peter Kilburn disappeared in Beirut. The American hostage situation was growing dire.
For Hezbollah's next capture, Ahmad settled on a sympathetic target, a Catholic priest named Father Joseph Curtin. Like the two men kidnapped before him, Father Joseph Curtin was harmless. He belonged to the Catholic Relief Services in South Beirut, which was a great asset to the community, especially its disaffected Shia population. In choosing this very unlikely target, Ahmad hoped to make the U.S. understand once and for all that Hezbollah would stop at nothing until their demands were met.
As with the kidnappings before him, Father Joseph would be intercepted on his way to work. But as the date drew near, Hezbollah was unaware that Father Joseph had left the country and Father Jenko had taken his place.
When Father Jenko landed in Beirut on October 1st, 1984, Lebanon's civil war was in one of its most heated episodes. His daily work was calm enough, but nightfall frequently brought chaos to the street.
On one of his first nights, Father Jenko was laying in bed, recovering from a long day of work.
Suddenly, shots rang out beneath his bedroom window. Then, a cascade of automatic weapon fire erupted, causing the glass in his window to rattle. Paralyzed with fear, Father Jenko started to recite a familiar prayer.
A loud bomb interrupted his thoughts, followed closely by a second explosion. The walls of his apartment quivered. Terrified, Father Jenko flung himself onto the floor. He reached up and snatched the mattress off his bed frame, using it to cover his body, praying to make it till morning.
These nighttime episodes became more and more frequent. One night, he even found the courage to crawl out from under his mattress. He wrote a prayer in large letters on his bedroom wall. It said, "Dear God, I will to live."
During his first Christmas in Beirut, the 50-year-old priest began experiencing strange chest pains. He was just 3 years younger than his dad had been when he died of a sudden heart attack. Father Jenko was not about to take that risk.
On the morning of January 7th, 1985, he visited a physician for a series of tests. The results wouldn't be ready for several days, so the doctor recommended that he spend the remainder of the day relaxing at home. Father Jenko felt strange not going to the mission when there was always so much work to do, but he was legitimately worried about his health. They would have to get by without him.
Father Jenko returned home, where he spent the afternoon resting. He had no idea it would be his last night in the apartment once owned by Father Joseph Curtin.
On the morning of January 8th, 1985, 50-year-old Father Lawrence Martin Jenko woke up feeling more rested than he had since before he arrived in Beirut in October. He cheerfully performed Mass and cooked breakfast before heading downstairs to wait for his driver.
His driver, Khalid, arrived promptly at 7:30 a.m., and the pair took off through the bustling streets of Beirut, eventually rounding a corner near the American University. Father Jenko took in the familiar sights, college students rushing to class, parents hurrying their small children down the sidewalks on their way to school.
Father Jenko's eyes settled on a strange sight up ahead. A grocer, wearing his dirty apron, stood in the middle of the road directing traffic. A small group of policemen were chatting on the sidewalk, paying no attention. It was an odd role reversal, or so he told Khalid.
The words had barely left his mouth when a sharp cascade of gunfire pierced the morning calm. A group of men jumped into the road, firing their automatic weapons wildly into the air. Then they began to run straight towards Father Jenko's car. They were all looking at him.
Hearing more gunfire, Father Jenko turned to see two more men rushing the car from behind.
In a flash, he recalled the news of American kidnappings in Beirut. With terror in his voice, he said, "Khalid, I'm about to be kidnapped."
Suddenly, the doors of the car flung open. The men pulled Father Jenko and Khalid from their seats and shoved them into the back of the vehicle. Two of their captors piled in on either side, while three more men wedged into the front. Outside, the four policemen had vanished.
Father Jenko watched as the man in front of him viciously ripped out the side compartment and began rifling through the vehicle documents. He wondered what the man could possibly be looking for.
They barreled down the street. Inside the car, everyone was silent. The captors knew that Khalid would understand every word they said. Father Jenko didn't dare to look at Khalid beside him or the complete stranger on his other side.
A few minutes passed and they turned onto a road facing the sea and parked next to a mosque. Father Jenko watched as they yanked Khalid out of the car and locked him in the trunk. Then they marched Father Jenko over to a second car, pushing him onto the floor in the back seat. The men piled in, and off they sped.
As they drove, Father Jenko noticed the growing sound of airplanes. They were entering South Beirut, near the airport. The car stopped on an empty suburban street, and Father Jenko was transferred into the trunk.
As he crawled inside, his beloved Silver Cross necklace fell off his neck. He gasped and reached out for it, but he wasn't quick enough. One of the men snatched it away, never to be seen again.
Alone in the trunk, without his cross to cling to, Father Jenko grappled with the possibility that he might not survive this nightmare.
The car stopped in a secluded suburb of South Beirut. As his captors jostled him out of the trunk, Father Jenko caught a glimpse of the Mediterranean Sea glistening in the bright January sun. Then his eyes rested on where they were taking him. An old, beat-up car. Father Jenko knew this type of car. It was the kind used for car bombs. They shoved him into the trunk.
Coming up, Father Jenko encounters one of the most harrowing experiences of his captivity. Now, back to the story.
On the morning of January 8, 1985, 50-year-old Father Lawrence Martin Jenko was curled up in the trunk of an old, beat-up car, the kind used for car bombs. He had been kidnapped by Hezbollah extremists on his way to work at the Catholic Relief Services mission in Beirut. Now he was huddled in the dark, wondering whether he was about to die. Meanwhile, his captors stood outside, speaking feverishly in Arabic.
Father Jenko wished he knew their language so he could understand what was happening. A small hole let light into the trunk. He tried to adjust himself to see through it, but the men banged harshly on the trunk's lid.
After what felt like hours, his captors piled into the car. As they drove, Father Jenko was finally able to reposition himself and look through the hole, but all he could see was the paved road below.
When the car finally stopped, they were outside of a partially constructed one-story building. His captors hustled him inside, into an unfinished bathroom with a dirt floor. An old bathtub sat in one corner. They made Father Jenko sit on a cement block as they stripped him to his undershirt. If this was an intimidation tactic, it worked. Father Jenko felt exposed and anxious.
At last, one of the men spoke. He said, "Are you Joseph Curtin?"
Confused, Father Jenko responded that he was not Joseph Curtin and told them his full name. But the men persisted, asking the same question over and over.
Well, Father Jenko's heart leapt with a wonderful realization. They had kidnapped the wrong person. Perhaps this was just a big misunderstanding that could be undone. He was new to their country. What threat could he possibly be to them?
He tried to explain that Father Joseph had left the country in October, 3 months earlier. He wanted to assure them that their mistake was understandable, nothing to be upset about. As he explained the mix-up to his captors, Father Jenko tried to stay calm and pleasant, hoping to increase his chances of being released.
Well, this was a smart move on Father Jenko's part. According to clinical psychologist Janice Villhauer, many of us respond to stress according to the old adage, hope for the best, but plan for the worst. However, an attitude of planning for the best actually helps us take proactive steps in stressful circumstances. A great way to begin is by simply asking ourselves if there is any action we can take to improve the situation. This sets us on a path of planning for the best, which increases our chances at having a better outcome.
When Father Jenko recognized the possibility that he could be released, he asked himself if there was anything he could do to proactively help his situation and purposefully spoke in a calm, pleasant tone of voice. He knew that if his captors found him likable, he would have a better chance at being let go.
After Father Jenko had calmly explained the misunderstanding, the men in the room seemed to believe him and dispersed. But they didn't let him go.
As the sun began to set, the bathroom grew colder. Father Jenko mustered the courage to make eye contact with the man standing guard, but a chill ran through him as the guard hissed, "You're dead."
At about 9:30 p.m., a weary Father Jenko was brought into a finished living room in the house. He could tell from the decorations that it belonged to a traditional Muslim family. His captors offered him a hamburger and soda for dinner, but his stomach was churning with anxiety. He couldn't imagine trying to eat.
A guard then placed headphones over his ears, just in case Father Jenko was able to understand them after all. As they turned their backs and began to converse, Father Jenko closed his eyes. He started to pray. He prayed and prayed until, exhausted, he finally fell asleep.
Father Jenko's captors woke him up early the next morning to use the toilet. When he stepped outside of the bathroom, one of the men wrapped an old sweater around his head as a blindfold. They then guided him outside and into yet another car trunk.
As they drove, Father Jenko tried to stay hopeful. There was still a chance he could be released without ever knowing who had kidnapped him or where he had been the night before.
The car came to a stop in what sounded like an echoey garage. Dread sank in once more as he heard the sound of boards being pounded together. Were they building him a coffin?
After a while, the pounding stopped, and Father Jenko's captors helped him out of the trunk. They adjusted his makeshift blindfold, then stuffed a piece of cloth in his mouth. The dry texture of the cloth made him gag, but the worst had not yet begun.
Grabbing his arms and legs, the men instructed him to stand as straight as a pin. Father Jenko heard the sound of tape being unwound from its spool. The men proceeded to wind it around every inch of his head except for his nostrils. Then they moved to his ankles, slowly working their way up until his legs were bound together and his arms were taped down at his sides. He'd been mummified alive.
They picked up his rigid body and slid him into what felt like a coffin. Later, Father Jenko would realize that he had been inserted underneath a truck bed into the shallow box where the tires were stored.
As they began to drive, the metal box grew hot and exhaust fumes began to pour into the confined space. Father Jenko felt like he was choking and burning at the same time. He began to panic, to sweat with anxiety.
Then, the truck hit a bump in the road. Father Jenko's body slammed against the top of the box, and slowly, his nostrils began to fill with blood. And with his hands taped at his sides, there was nothing he could do. He was sure he was going to suffocate.
Father Jenko fought to calm himself down, quickly recalled the meditation prayer of the Russian Orthodox mystics, "Lord Jesus, have mercy on me, a sinner."
He repeated the simple cadence over and over. It helped to keep his breathing under control as the hours of driving crept by.
Once in a while, the truck idled. He couldn't hear anything over the engine, but he figured they were stopping at military checkpoints. He prayed that someone would find him. If only he could scream for help. He tried to stay focused on his breathing, but with every minute he felt himself growing more delirious.
Finally, the truck came to a full stop. As his captors dragged him from underneath the truck bed, Father Jenko was barely conscious.
He felt his body being lifted off the ground and carried up what felt like several flights of stairs before stopping. Then he hit the ground with a thud.
Gradually, the commotion died down. When he thought it might be safe, Father Jenko tore off his sweater blindfold and gasped for air.
They took off the tape, but put the blindfold back on. Voices began to speak in rapid Arabic.
Gradually, the commotion died down. When he thought it might be safe, Father Jenko tore off his sweater blindfold and gasped for air.
Two guards jumped. One of them shot Father Jenko a warning look and, in broken English, said, "When anyone comes into this building, you must have a blindfold on."
They guided him into the guards' sleeping quarters and sat him facing the wall. Father Jenko's stomach began to grumble. He looked up at one of the guards and made an eating motion with his fingers. The man left and returned a few minutes later, carrying a warm pan of canned green beans mixed with tomato sauce. It was hostage cuisine, but it tasted wonderful.
Later that afternoon, his guards moved him into a dingy kitchen in the apartment, where they chained him to another radiator.
When they finally allowed him to use the bathroom, Father Janko spied a tiny window near the ceiling. Standing on the toilet seat, he could look down over a beautiful valley below. He spied scattered Roman ruins and immediately knew where he was. They were somewhere in the hills overlooking Lebanon's Bekaa Valley.
After he finished in the bathroom, the guards returned Father Janko to the kitchen, where they handed him a mat to sleep on. Then they left the room.
Alone in the silence, a wave of relief washed over him, tinged with misery. He looked across the kitchen and spied a window closely facing a cement wall. Between the cracks in the cement blocks, he could see snow beginning to fall. Father Janko could not hold his breaking heart together anymore. There, on the dingy kitchen floor, he began to cry. Little did he know, this would be the most humane part of his captivity.
Next week, we'll follow Father Lawrence Martin Janko's terrible living conditions and the abuse he endured at the hands of Hezbollah. We'll also delve into his family's campaign for his release and the stirrings of a covert plan by the U.S. government to gain freedom for the hostages in Lebanon. Thanks again for tuning in to Hostage. We'll be back next Thursday with a new episode.
You can find more episodes of Hostage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify.
Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easier for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals like Hostage for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker.
To stream Hostage on Spotify, just open the app, tap Browse, and type Hostage in the search bar.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted.
Hostage was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. Executive producers include Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Juan Borda, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, Travis Clark, and Paul Mahler. This episode of Hostage was written by Ali Wicker, with writing assistance by Maggie Admire, and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.